Hello, everyone. I am here in London and I am in a Google Hangout with Howard and Sandra Taylor. If you guys can both say hello to everyone.
Hi. Let's go at the same time. My name's Howard Taylor and hello from Orem, Utah, London.
Yep. And then Sandra.
And I'm Sandra Taylor. And I'm also in Orem, Utah.
Yep.
So
Howard and Sandra Taylor are probably most well known for Schlock Mercenary, the web comic. And so I'm going to let them sort of give just a dummy's guide to what Schlock Mercenary is.
That probably falls to me, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yes.
Schlock Mercenary is, in a nutshell, epic science fiction being told four panels at a time. It's formatted like a newspaper comic might be formatted, with short daily installments of four panels-ish, and longer Sunday installments, but unlike modern newspaper comics, and a lot like the old Buck Rogers serials of the 40s, Schlock Mercenary is telling a long-form story. Unlike Buck Rogers, I'm putting in a punchline, some sort of humorous payoff every day at the end. And I've spent a whole lot more time telling you about the format than telling you about what's actually in the format. Epic science fiction. It is a story about heroes who happen to be mercenaries who hurt people and break things for money, but they really are heroic, if a little flawed. Accepting money to do things that the average galactic citizen might not be able to. It's set in kind of a far-flung future, around 1,000 years from now. But the Schlock Mercenary universe is neither a strictly dystopian view nor a utopian view. It's a universe in which every four panels there's a punchline, which I guess is dystopian if you're the person upon whom the joke is. There's action, there's violence, there's a little bit of romance, there are big guns, there are little guns, there are main characters who only have one mouth, great big blobs of, I call them carbosilicate amorphs, and that's our title character, Sergeant Schlock.
Who's not a human.
Penchant for violence and an oral fixation all wrapped up in one sort of sociopathic everyman character.
Mm-hmm. So. And on formats that you can view Schlock Mercenary on, there's of course the website, schlockmercenary.com.
Schlockmercenary.com, there's an iPhone app and an Android app. If you go out looking for apps and just search for Schlock Mercenary, you'll find it. So anything that runs Android, anything that runs iOS, the app will run on. And of course, we sell Dead Tree editions. The Dead Trees have not yet caught up with the current material that's online on the app. The books are where we make most of our money.
And the books also contain extras that aren't available to the app.
There's a lot of marginalia, maps, deck plans, concept art, and some bonus stories. Each book to date has had 5 to 15 pages of bonus material that gives you a little bit of backstory and characters on the characters, maybe tells you a little bit about what happened between a couple of the books. Things that I couldn't fit into the continuity without fouling the pacing or the plot arcs.
It has been nominated for 3 Hugos or 4 Hugos at this point?
Four.
Yeah, so 4-time Hugo nominated as well.
Oh, yeah, and for those of you not benefiting from the video, I just waggled my fingers.
Yeah, four fingers in the air.
It was a very stylish flourish.
Yes, it was.
And sadly, it's lost.
Unfortunately, yes. But that means they also can't see my hair, so we're good.
Can't see my hair either, but moving on.
Yeah, you have to pull up a picture of Howard to get
see
that joke.
His lovely baldness, yes.
So Schlock Mercenary has been nominated for Hugo every year that the category for webcomic has been open, correct? Or is it, what is the category?
The category is for best graphic story.
Okay.
And Schlock Mercenary, the Schlock Mercenary demographic is very, very well represented among the sci-fi fandom and among, in the military. Fans who happen to be active duty or have been active duty. The comic gets passed around there a lot. And as we all know, or as we all should know, the Hugo Awards are basically a popularity contest. If you've got 100,000 people reading your work and 2,000 of them happen to be regular Hugo attendees or regular Worldcon attendees, it's pretty likely that you're going to garner a nomination. Not necessarily with how awesome my comic is.
Well, I wouldn't.
Everything to do with how awesome my fans are.
Yeah. For the uninitiated, the Nebulas are kind of like the Academy Awards. They are voted on by other members of the Science Fiction Writers of America, which is basically our guild, and there is no category for something like Schlock Mercenary specifically for those. Hugos have a lot more categories, and they are voted on by all the attendees of the World Science Fiction Convention, and so they are more like a People's Choice Awards, or they're fan-based awards, and they have a much broader voting base. I met Sandra Taylor at the Nebula Awards, and we were actually sharing stories about our various home businesses around the table, and Sandra had a really funny story to tell about an email that you guys got. Now, if you go and look at the Schlock Mercenary website, it looks very polished. There could be a Viacom or somebody behind a website like that. And so one of your fans was irate to get an out-of-office reply from... from an email, and when Sandra explained that you guys were on vacation, they said, well, how irresponsible is it to have every single person in your office go on vacation at the same time? I don't think people realize oftentimes that it's a family-run business, and yeah, it's you two guys. So is it just you guys, or do you have any other employees at this point?
We have a colorist who does all the coloring for the comic strip. And we have an extremely part-time shipping assistant. Mm-hmm. And then we frequently hire the children to do odd jobs and they get paid for that. Mm-hmm. Other than that, it's just, we've also sometimes paid neighbor children as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, and we've contracted design work from folks. We have a lot of, I can't call them business partners, but they are, or excuse me, I can't call them employees, mm-hmm. And they're not quite to the level of business partner, but they are doing work that a lot of web cartoonists would do themselves. Okay. Tyler Martin and John Bintz handled all of our website design and continue to handle the hosting for Schlock Mercenary, so that's not something I worry about. Sandra mentioned the colorist. There's also Graham Bradley, who's done some Adobe Illustrator work for us. Melissa Mayhew's done some Adobe Illustrator work for us.
Gary Henson did the app.
How could I forget that? Yeah, Gary Henson, Plus 14 Limited, did the app, and he and I are in a 50-50 revenue share agreement on that. He's a brilliant programmer. And then there was Nick Vitek, Kevin Nunn, Kevin... I've forgotten the other Kevin's name. It'd feel awful.
Rusky.
Kevin Nunn, Kevin Rusky of Living World Games and Ape Games, with whom we partnered for all of the Schlock Mercenary game stuff.
Yeah.
And so this is not, I mean, while it is a family business, the temptation in a lot of businesses is to say, oh, the more things I do myself, the more money I make. And the fact of the matter is, the more things you do yourself that you're not good at, the closer you come to just running your business off a cliff and destroying it. It makes sense to partner early with people who can help you, and that's what we've done.
Right. The things that are completely in-house, all of the drawing and writing Howard does, all of the book design and book production I do, I run all of the shipping, all of the accounting, all of the customer support. That's all in-house, very, very literally.
As in your actual house?
In my actual house, yeah. A third of our house is devoted to the business. Howard has an office. I have an office. I have a room that is completely inventory and shipping space. Out of our house, we have two storage units, which is where we store our thousands of books that are waiting for people to buy them.
So you don't do print on demand, you do print runs and store them?
We do print runs.
Okay.
We have thousands of books sitting in a storage unit right at this moment. So
let's talk about the evolution then of Schlock Mercenary and how it came to be. So it began in 2000, is that correct?
That is correct. Howard had apparently been thinking about it off and on for a while, that drawing webcomics was a thing. The first awareness I have had of it was that he came to me and said, "Honey, I think I'll take up doodling as a hobby." And I said, "You do that. That sounds like a fun hobby." And so he did. He started drawing, and we made a space on the kitchen table. I mean, he started. And then within a week, suddenly he had a business plan and was going to put these all up on the internet. And I think it was probably 2 years later before, I mean, I was always supportive of it as a hobby, but it was a couple of years later before I really saw it as a viable business model. And
saw it as a business from week two.
Mm-hmm. I know you did. It took me a little longer, but I... And this is the important thing. I mean, it was a thing he wanted to do, and I completely supported it, but it was several years before I could see that it was actually, a business, and that he was really, that it could go someplace.
And so before Schlock Mercenary, what were you guys doing for day jobs, for the bringing in the income, supporting the family
kind of thing? We were extremely traditional. Howard had a corporate job for 11 years, and I was a stay-at-home mother.
I was tech support and then inbound product marketing, which is basically means I collect information and communicate it to development for a company called Novell. Mm-hmm. I was managing all of that for $100 million suite of communications collaboration software called Groupwise.
So you were a computer background tech guy?
Computer background, but I was the wetware side of the technology. I was all about, working with people, working with the users, making sure that the product was geared towards the needs of the user community. I didn't actually write code. I supported code for a while. And I thought at one point it might be fun to write code because I'm creative. But the learning curve was pretty steep there and I got bored. That was like 96 when I thought about writing code. I gave that up within 3 months.
And your degree originally was in?
Music.
Music at BYU?
Yep.
So you've got that artistic background.
Music composition, sound recording technology. I spent 5 years from 94 to 99. Moonlighting as a record producer. Sandra was actually the operations chief for Sanctus Records. Sandra was the chief financial.
Yeah,
I did. Was CFO. I was chief of operations. My buddy Rick McFarland was the chief exec. And we put out 15 or so albums during that period of time. And then by 99, 2000, we kind of decided, this is not making any money. We're making wonderful music. We're doing fantastic things, but as a business, it's failing. So we handed all of the inventory off to another local record company. All of the IP, all of the business relationships, all of that. And
what that did for us, we came out of it probably $10,000 poor, and we just considered that tuition. It taught us how not to run a business, and the main problem was not in production. We were pretty good at production. We were not good at marketing at that point. And so we just, wrapped that all up and said, well, that was good. And when we quit that, I think that's when the space opened up for Howard to start thinking about comics and to start thinking about telling stories. And that's, it's really not very much time between the end of that business and the start of Schlock Mercenary.
Right from the get-go, you saw it as a business. Whereas Sandra...
I knew as I started doing this, well, when I told Sandra I want to take up doodling as a hobby, that was 100% honest. I had no ulterior motive. I just thought, you know, drawing looks like fun. Music has kind of burned me a little bit. And so I did some doodling, and I got bitten by the bug. You know, I just fell in love with line art, with cartooning, with sequential art. I was not nearly as good at it as I thought I was. I thought I was okay at it. I was really bad at it, but I had stories to tell, and almost immediately, you know, within 2 weeks, I started creating characters, started laying out strips. I had voices in my head yammering about dialogue and punchlines and whatnot. And I talked with my brother and one of my friends about it, and you know, we'd go back and forth a little bit about what would be fun in a science fiction comedy. And then it was, like I said, 2 weeks. Within about 2 weeks, I realized, I don't want to do this for a living. And started cooking a business plan. And the original business plan, from a 10,000-foot view, the original business plan was do this on the side, online, for 10 years. Before the 10 years is up, I will have signed some sort of publishing contract with somebody. But by the end of the 10 years, we will have sold enough books, we'll be selling enough new books that the publishing royalties will have made up for, you know, equaled my Novell salary, and I'll be able to quit. So that was the 10-year plan. Turns out we did it in, I quit Novell after 4 years, and we still don't have the full Novell salary back.
No.
Like the quality of life is so much better, and I was overpaid. But we were paying the bills. We were fully self-sufficient as a family business supporting a cartoonist by late 2006.
Yes.
And so, from your point of view, Sandra, what was that whole journey like for you?
It was I was with Howard the whole time. I never thought it was wrong. The first 4 years, the first couple of years, it was just a fun thing. It was fun. And then I started seeing it as a real business, and he started pouring more time into it, because it needed it. And those last 2 years, at Novell, so that would be 2002 to 2004, were pretty miserable in a lot of ways. Howard was not available. He would go to work, and work was, you know, demanding 40 to 60 hours a week from him. And then he would come home and spend 20 hours a week on the comic. So, you know, he was working 80-hour weeks, which meant as a family, we just didn't see him very much. And I could see that it was killing him. It was just really hard. And so when we both strongly felt in 2004 that it was just, you know, something had to change, and we're religious people, and so we went in prayer and said, what do we do? The answer was quit the day job, which really kind of surprised and scared us, but we could feel that it was completely the right choice.
We'd been thinking about this for, the better part of a year and a half. And,
yeah.
You know, every time we prayed about it, the answer that we felt like we were getting was save money, squirrel things away, and stay the course, hang in there. And then in September of 2004, we both prayed about it. We both realized it's time. I don't feel ready. It's time. How can this possibly be time? We've saved maybe 3 months of bills in the bank. It can't possibly be time. But the impressions that we got were really unmistakable. Really unmistakable. And it wasn't just, it's time. to put in 2 weeks' notice. It was time for me to go talk to HR and say, look, if you want 2 weeks' notice, I'll give you 2 weeks' notice, but I'd really rather just leave tomorrow. And I did.
Yeah. And the reactions to that were very, very fascinating. There were a lot of people who just couldn't believe that he was doing that. There were some people who were actually threatened by it. They kind of wanted the cartooning to fail.
I got word from a friend of mine at Nobel that there were guys who were saying, oh, he'll be back. They always come back. Nobel's corporate culture was very, very unhealthy at the time. Sort of the lobster pit corporate culture. Somebody tries to climb out, people claw them back in. And yet we had layoffs all the time. And you talk to people who get laid off, they're like, oh man, being laid off was so scary and not having a salary was so miserable, but I'm so much happier now that I'm working for this and such. Or now that I've, hey, I decided to open my own business. And so when I went off and started cartooning, what was really happening for some folks at Nobel was they were threatened by their decision to stay at Nobel was one that was being shown as maybe not the best decision. If people could succeed outside and be happier, well, let's think about that for a moment. If you are doing thing A with a bunch of other people who are doing thing A, and then somebody else stops and does thing B and is happier and better off and tells you about it, you can either jump over to thing B or convince yourself that you really are happier than they are doing thing A, that they're an abnormality. And you know what? I'm happy to be considered an abnormality. People come up to me all the time and say, oh, you're such an inspiration. I think I'm going to quit my job. And I scream at them, no, don't do that. That way lies madness. I don't want to say that we were unprepared because we did everything we could to prepare, but we did not know what was coming. We were completely blind in this matter. And when we say that the Lord told us it is time to quit your day job at Nobel, the answer that we got to our prayers was not, you are going to be a successful cartoonist. The answer we got was, it is now time to leave Nobel, and you have my permission to have a go at this cartooning thing. And so we did, and the real blessing for leaving corporate work was that we had me back in the family again. And honestly, if I had opened a bicycle shop or a restaurant or something and been able to pay the bills and be a part of the family, that also would have functioned as the promised blessing for adhering to that answer we got. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and actually, that's something all the three of us actually have in common. We're all members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So, we all definitely have that worldview. That's why I'm talking to you from a very small apartment in London. Not the typical life decision to make when your husband is a successful career at Los Alamos National Laboratory. So let's spend a little more time here with you, Sandra. I think a lot of people think of Schlock Mercenary, and they think of the artistic input of Schlock Mercenary as Howard. And Howard's name is definitely very prominent for a very good reason. But he is not the only creative input in this franchise at all. What was your background before you were a stay-at-home mom, and even while you were a stay-at-home mom?
Right. I graduated from BYU with a degree in humanities, which I took because I did not like math, and that major didn't require any of it, and so that was a major driving force. But also I loved art and literature, and I loved the study of human expression, and so while math was a consideration, I really loved what humanities offered to me. We got married, and I started having kids before I even graduated. I finished up my degree through independent study so I could be home with my oldest daughter. And then I spent the next 10 years doing stay-at-home mom stuff. I was at home with the kids. There were some health issues. We moved a couple of times. And I was just completely wrapped up in that. I started doing business things with Howard during the record production years. And most of that began with me taking over the family accounting. So I was just doing the family accounting because Howard was busy. So I started doing that. And then I started doing the business accounting. And so I learned all my business accounting stuff really on the job. And for years, I was completely terrified that I was doing it all wrong and the IRS was going to swoop down and take everything away from us. And I think I finally shed that fear the year when I went to our tax accountant, because while I do the regular bookkeeping, we have an actual certified tax accountant, which serves as a nice checkup once a year to make sure that I wasn't actually making all those mistakes. And the year that he, you know, shook my hand and complimented me on how organized everything was, I realized, oh, well, okay, so I'm probably doing as well as or better than the average business owner. So, you know, I'm okay with this. When Howard started doing the comic, I have since the very beginning served as his first reader. He will write a script. He will bring me the scripts so that they have the words. There's no pictures on them yet. And so sometimes he will have to say, okay, this in this panel, Schlock is doing this, so that I can kind of picture it. But my job is essentially to read it. I don't actually have to do very much commenting unless something jumps out at me. He mostly reads, he watches me read it, and he, you know, he sees where I pause. He sees where I laugh. He sees, and sometimes I will not have said a word, and he will kind of grab it back and realize, okay, he needs to go fix something. But other times, and there are times where he'll need to talk through plot things, and I will listen to him, and I will say, okay, what about this, or this, these characters would, you know, what, and sometimes I will bring back a plot thread that I'm interested in, that he's kind of set down for a while, and I'll say, so what happens with Bunny and Rev? I want to know what happens there. And so I do some creative input there as well. I do a lot of emotional support, because, and that was one of the things that developed as we developed the business. We realized that there were some natural ebbs and flows. There are points in stories where Howard will always feel like he's doing a horrible job, and there are parts where he feels like he's doing well. And learning those patterns lets me be the one who stands there and says, yes, I know you feel like you're doing awful. You're not. Keep going. That kind of thing. I started doing the book design in 2007. Prior to that, we had a guy who was doing book design for us, and he decided that he was no longer going to do that. And I had, and it was Steve Troop of Melonpool.
He was awesome.
He was awesome. He did a great job, and I was working with him and helping him arrange the book stuff, but he needed to move on. And so I just looked at it and said, well, I just need to learn how to do this. So once again, I started doing a job and had to learn how to run the tools in design and stuff on the job. This is one of the strengths that Howard and I have. We both learn things extremely quickly, and we can learn them by ourselves from books, which over and over and over again in this business is like, well, I don't know how to do that, but give me 2 weeks and I will.
Yeah.
And it's kind of a scary way to live, because it was terrifying taking on the book design, because I didn't know how to run the program. I didn't know how to use the tools. And I knew that if I screwed it up, that was our family income. That was, you know, the only way we had to make money. And then, you know, on those are all the business things I do. And then there are the family things and the parenting things. And then I also write myself. So there's so many things. I answered your question there.
Yeah. And so according to just the Wikipedia article on Schlock Mercenary, it went through a relaunch in 2003. Is that correct? Or is that somebody?
Relaunch, not really the right word.
Okay.
But basically what I did I was working with Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games, who had offered to publish us. And we did a compilation of strips to submit to Diamond to see if Diamond was going to be interested in carrying the book. And Diamond looked at the early strips and basically said, no, I don't care how much publicity you put around this. We don't even want this in the catalog, which is not awesome. And we looked at the newer art and we thought, well, we could start with newer strips, but we want to make sure that the readers can follow along. So in 2003, I thought, well, we've just had some events that, you know, in the comic that basically had a new character come on who was going to be a fantastic foil for reintroducing the cast. And so I wrote the Under New Management storyline in a way that we could reintroduce the cast, and I called it a relaunch because Under New Management was the first book we laid out, and Diamond still didn't want to carry that. And I'll loop back around to that in a moment. But the result of that was not so much that I relaunched the comic; it was that I learned how to write the beginnings of books so that new readers could pick up the story without going all the way back to my eye-bleedingly bad artwork.
Yeah, Howard did not like his early artwork at all. And to this day, it still kind of causes him physical pain to look at it. When we first started putting out books, he didn't ever want to put that early artwork in books at all. He wanted to start with Under New Management and move forward. And it was after we came out with Blackness Between, the second book that we printed, that we'd heard enough from fans. They really, really wanted all of the stories in the books. And so we went back and did those first two books, which is why for a while there was confusion about the numbering of the books, because Under New Management was the first book in print, but it is the third book in the series. And the fans were right. We need to have all of the stories in print. So.
How much lag time is there between the strips that are coming out right now and the latest book published?
Currently about 5 years.
Yeah.
We need to fix that.
Well, and then, so does each book then encompass a year? Or how are the stories? It varies?
The longest book we've got right now is the very first book, Tub of Happiness, which is 507 days of strips, 240 some odd pages. But when we get around to putting Massively Parallel in print, Massively Parallel is going to be closer to 280 pages. It's going to be quite a bit larger. Massively Parallel ran for 19 months under new management, or not under new management, Tub of Happiness, I think is 15 months.
So it's dictated by story length, not...
It's really dictated by, it's dictated by story. And I've gotten better at signposting and staking things out. But I'll start writing a week of strips and I'll realize this is a joke that I need to come at from three or four different ways in order to write a proper week of strips. And this is part of the format, and this is where the format fouls up conventional storytelling. I will do a week of comics, and the week of comics will spend far more time with this character or this setting or this scene than maybe that scene needed in terms of plot. But that's because I am doing a send-up of something else. I'm telling a joke, I'm writing satire, there's a little bit of author's message or whatever going on in there, and I will noodle around for longer than the plot requires. If I were being tightly edited, if I were doing this in prose and then submitting the manuscript, there'd be half a dozen darlings in every book that needed to die, and I know exactly where they'd be. But when they run on the web, people love them because they are tuning in daily for a punchline.
And so, yeah, carry on.
I was going to say the dailiness of the punchlines. It's this fascinating balance of writing for the book and writing for the daily readers. And it sometimes will, you know, people will complain, and this usually happens towards the beginning of the book, that things are going slowly. You know, what they haven't shot anything or nothing's exploded for weeks. And it's because we're at the beginning of the book and Howard is setting up pieces. This happened particularly the beginning of the last book, where Howard was putting in together a lot of pieces and putting in all of these things he was going to need later. And then towards the end of the book, we got so much good response from the regular readers saying, oh my gosh, this is a great story. This is amazing. And it's because he took the time to put all those pieces into place earlier. And so, you know, watching him balance, I get to watch front row seat and I don't know how he does it. So.
You just keep flapping.
Yeah, that's right.
Bumblebee technique. I don't know how I do it either.
Bumblebees don't know how they fly. They just keep flapping. Anyway, you were going to say?
I was going to say, as far as your business goes, what proportion of your income roughly comes from sales of the books? And then what are your other revenue sources for Schlock Mercenary? Is it pretty much all sales of the books?
Spitballing it. Book sales are 40%. Advertising is about 30%. And other merchandise is about 30%.
So advertising, selling ad space on schlockmercenary.com?
Yeah.
And then the other merchandise includes the t-shirts and such that you've got on.
T-shirts, mugs, board games, magnets, prints, commissions. I don't do very many commissions, but when I do. And if I had to adjust those numbers, like I said, spitballing the first time around, I would adjust the percentage between merchandising and books.
Yeah.
When we've got a book release, we will net enough to pay the minimum bills in the house for 6 months. But you know, this January we released, what was it, mugs and hats?
Yeah.
And we've made more this January than we've made any previous January. The Amazon ad revenue I've gotten has been better than Amazon ad revenue has ever been. And the other turnkey ad systems I've been using have also performed well. And so this month's revenue, the money that comes in this month, is going to pay the bills for at least two more months, maybe three. It's not quite a book release month, but it's being kind of awesome. I'm not sure how the percentages will look in the future. I don't know if paper is going out of style. We just need to be nimble.
This is one of the things that frequently, you know, becomes one of our midnight terrors, is that, you know, will people stop buying books? So much of this business is out of our control and in the hands of, you know, the thousands of fans who actually spend their money with us. And so in a lot of ways, I have to view it as, you know, a gift that they give us the opportunity to keep doing this. And so we keep trying to make awesome things for them to enjoy so that they will keep giving us that gift. We've got this January, we made enough for a couple of months, which is probably enough time for us to start the printing process on the next book. And it's a very, It's always like that. It's always got to move to the next thing because before the money runs out. And the money hasn't run out, but I keep being afraid it will. So.
Let's talk a little bit about the game. Because that was a collaboration, correct?
Yes.
Do one of you want to tell us a little bit about how that came together?
WorldCon in Denver, World Science Fiction Convention in Denver, sat down, had a great conversation with a new friend, Lawrence Schoen and now I've forgotten the important one. I knew this was going to happen.
Walter.
Walter Hunt, yes, yeah. Thank you. I was going to say Warren. No, it's not Warren.
Yeah, Walter.
Walter. Walter Hunt. Walter is a board game aficionado and attends a very small, private, invitation-only event for board gamers. And he, after meeting me, he thought, oh, I'm going to go read his comic. Fell in love with the comic. And then when he was at this event, which includes board game aficionados and board game designers, he talked to some friends of his and said, you guys should totally do a Schlock Mercenary game. And they looked at the comic and thought, oh, wow, we should. And thus began a collaboration that ran for about 2 years, some back and forth. And there was one point at which the designer, Kevin Nunn, said, hey, you know what? It's not working. I'm just going to throw all of this in the trunk and start again. Just like a novelist will sometimes do. It goes in the trunk and you start again. And maybe if you need to raid it for a little bit of world building, you do. At Gen Con in 2011, they laid out a prototype in front of me and we were going to play it. And I remember going into it thinking, this has taken too long, this process. I'm just not sure. I need to find a way to break the news to them that it's just probably time to kill the project. And then I played the game and I had a blast. And I told them that. I was up front. I said, you know what? I came into this. I sat down trying to find a way to kill this. And you've won me over. And if you've won me over under those circumstances, then yes, you've got a good game. So we put a Kickstarter project together for November, December of that year. The Kickstarter raised $81,000, and that was, at the time, the number two all-time Kickstarter for board games. It has since been, it fell off the list like 4 months later, completely out of the top 10 of that list. But we, you know, raised a bunch of money for games, and then in 2012, I did a bunch of artwork and shipped it off to Nick, and they built a game out of it, and we had some production problems and some snafus and some confusion and frustration and whatever else, and some of that is still going on. It's not a perfect partnership when you start factoring in distribution angles and getting the game into stores, but in terms of delivering the product to the people who supported it on Kickstarter, it's fantastic. We've heard nothing but good things about it, and we continue to carry it in our store. Living World Games carries it in theirs, and your local game store can get it through Alliance or through ACD.
Yep. I was going to ask one more question about Schlock Mercenary and then move on to talking about other projects that you guys are doing. The 70 Maxims of Maximally Effective Mercenaries. I have to say my favorite is, if violence wasn't your last resort, you failed to resort to enough of it. Yes. Do you guys have any favorites out of those?
I did a write-up for, Jen Brozek. Over on Jen Brozek blog, I did a write-up where I talked about what it takes to write these maxims. Being pithy in a way that sounds like an aphorism, sounds like a proverb, a modern day sort of horribly violent proverb. and one of the best for me is a soft answer turneth away wrath. Once wrath is looking the other way, shoot it in the head. And that is, it's pithy. It's funny, and it's a subversion. It works because we take somebody that everybody knows and we subvert it. And I mean, examples of subversion, I use it all the time, but examples of subversion from popular culture that listeners may be familiar with. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for I am the biggest son of a bitch in the valley. You know, we've heard that one. That's a common military aphorism. And it's a subversion of scripture. And then there's, there was another one that was leaping to mind, and now I've forgotten it. Oh, the footprints poem.
Yeah.
You know, the footprints poem that we all have heard so many times. And if you're Mormon, you've heard it even more times, but it gets used about twice a year in sacrament feeding thoughts. The last line, Jesus is supposed to say, "My precious child, when you only saw one set of footprints, that was when I carried you." And the subversion is, "My precious child, when you saw but one set of footprints, we were walking single file to hide our numbers from the sand people." And so, there's your little, there's your humor lesson on subversion. When we do the Maxims, I like subverting things. I can't rely on that exclusively, because then it's the 70 subversions of maximally effective pirates. But subversion is always a good way to start, because you get into the voice of proverbia, of aphorisms. That was a much longer answer than you wanted.
It's all good. Do you have a favorite one, Sandra?
I don't tend to carry them in my head so much. Pillage then burden leaps to mind, but that's probably because I've put so many t-shirts with that saying into packages. And then I do like Wrath is shoot it in the head, that one. I enjoy.
And it was originally 7, correct? And
The original plan was, again, subversion. I was subverting the 7 habits of highly effective people as the 7 habits of highly effective pirates. But I wanted more than 7, and so it was kind of a clunky fit. And then I got a cease and desist from Covey, who, in spite of the fact that my 7 habits jokes preceded their filing for a patent on the phrase, trademark on the phrase 7 habits. Despite the fact, you know, they went after anybody who was saying really the 7 anythings. And I got that cease and desist and realized, you know what, this is a good opportunity to just retcon the whole thing. And I came up, you know, in one day, I came up with the term 70 maxims of maximally effective mercenaries. It still flows off the tongue, although, well, tumbles, I guess, is a little more apt. And now it makes room for me to keep writing until I've got, you know, 5 years and change worth of calendars I can sell to people. And if that sounds crassly mercenary, well, which part of maximally effective habits of highly effective mercenaries? No, wait. Anyway, it's got mercenary right there in it. You should expect that behavior from it.
Schlock mercenary obviously is a huge part of your lives, but it certainly isn't the totality of your creative lives. Sandra, let's talk to you for a minute. You also are a writer, and so do you want to sort of talk about some of the projects that you've got going on right now?
Well, the biggest and most consistent of them is my blog, One Cobble at a Time. You can find it at onecobble.com. And it is essentially, I mean, it's a blog where I'm writing almost daily. Some of the entries are more like, this is what's going on in my day, and this is, you know, I shipped 500 packages today, and I'm really brain dead. Sometimes I talk about shows I'm watching. Other times, the entries are much more like personal essays or narrative nonfiction, where I'm actually trying to catch something that I thought about and pin it down into words. That's my biggest project. Last year and this year, I've taken just a sampling of the entries that are more like essays and pulled them into a book so that I have a physical paper-bound book that I can take with me and sell whenever I go and do presentations or go to conventions and things like that. Several years ago, it was in probably 2006, I wrote a picture book for my daughter that she really was having a rough kindergarten year, and there was a story that she needed to be able to come to terms with the fact that she's a very, very impulsive, wild idea kind of person, and she had to learn how to steer that. And so I wrote her a story, And then I realized that in kindergarten, you have to have pictures to go with your stories. So I contracted with an artist. Well, we briefly, like for 2 seconds, thought about having Howard do the art, and then realized that he was just far too busy, and his art style wasn't quite right anyway. So we contracted with an artist, and the book came out in 2008, and that's Hold On To Your Horses.
Which my boys are a big fan of, especially the younger one carries it up and asks to have it read to him. So I highly recommend it.
Yeah. I've written a sequel to that book that I, and the same artist, Angela Call, who did such wonderful pictures for the first book, has agreed to do pictures for the second book. We're going to need to run a Kickstarter to fund that. We'll probably run that sometime later this year. We have to figure out when it fits. When can we devote the energy to it?
We could do a podcast just on Kickstarter.
I'll be having a second picture book. Sometime soon, hopefully.
And are you also the book designer on the picture books?
Yes, I do the layout and design on that, which isn't that hard for the picture books because Angela, all I really have to do is take Angela's gorgeous pictures and stick them on the page.
I had to do all kinds of color correction,
you did that.
And it was RGB, and then we had to convert it to CMYK, and then you look at the CMYK and you print it and you realize that the digital version of CMYK is not the same as actually putting little drops of ink on the page. And so I learned all kinds of things doing the art correction on the first book. It'll be easier the second time around.
I'm also currently working on a novel, which is probably late middle grade or early YA novel. Querying around yet another book that is kind of a book of narrative nonfiction essays. So, you know, there's all of these things. It's interesting to try and build what amounts to a second career in the house while my day job is doing Schlock Mercenary, which doesn't make me very much different from any other writer who has a day job and, trying to build a creative career. What's interesting is that Howard is also trying to build a prose career, you know. So we've got the Schlock Mercenary business, which is what pays our bills, and then Howard's trying to build a prose career, and I'm trying to build a prose career. And this is kind of a crazy amount of work, but it's necessary because, like we said, we're not sure, you know, 10 years from now, will people still be buying books? And so we need to, for business reasons, we need to diversify. For emotional reasons, we need to follow the projects we're passionate about. And we are still passionate. We're passionate about Schlock Mercenary, but it is not the only thing that fascinates us. And we need to do these other things as well.
And is your novel, your middle grade, is it speculative fiction, or what's your typical genre?
The genre, I don't know if I have a typical yet. I haven't written enough books. It sure kind of looks like I'm all over the place. The genre for this one is a magical realism, which is a book where you can read the book believing that it's just the real world and that the magic is all imagined. Or you can read it saying, you know, believing that the magic is actually real, which is kind of a tricky line to walk. But I'm very interested in walking that line. It sounds like fun to me. So.
And then a bit of trivia: you're not the only writer in your family.
No.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the family
sister,
you grew up with?
Nancy, yeah, my sister Nancy Fulda writes speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy. She was Hugo-nominated last year for her short story Movement.
Yeah, Hugo and Nebula.
And Nebula, that's right, because that's why I was at the Nebulas, and that's where I met Emily.
Yeah.
And then on Howard's side, you know, he's got a brother, Randy Taylor, who's also very creative, writes the funniest Twitter feed I've ever read. So, and is working on novels and stories as well.
Very cool. Yeah, I had wondered actually if Nancy was the only one from your family.
My mother writes, and she's a
storyteller.
Yeah, she's an oral storyteller. She'll go to schools and tell stories, and so she's done a lot of writing and painting. My other two sisters have done some writing, but nothing that's been published. My brothers are all computer science programmers and tech geek kind of guys. So there's a lot of creativity. It's just it's expressed in lots of different ways.
So Howard, what else then do you have going on the side?
In August and September of last year, I wrote a novelette called Flight of the Runewright, which was straight-up horror suspense sci-fi. I didn't throw much humor in it, a little bit of character humor, but that was just there to break the tension long enough to, you know, set you up for the next fall. And it came out in a collection called Space Eldritch, which did really well. I blogged about it. It was a small publisher, micro publisher, really. But it had been really well received, and it was super fun to write. Immediately following that, I picked up a licensed project, working in somebody else's IP, and writing a novella for Privateer Press, which will appear in electronic formats only as part of their Skull Island Expeditions line. And that's been great fun. That second project is the first time I've gotten to work at a word rate, being paid by the word, with an editor who knows what the producer wants, knows what the publisher wants, knows what decisions need to be made with regard to world building. And there's been a lot of back and forth. It's the first time I've ever had the opportunity to do that. It is at turns frustrating and exhilarating. And if it works out well, if my readers and Privateer Press's readers love it, then I'm sure I'll do it again. And I will negotiate for even better pay, because schlock mercenary, which of those two words doesn't suggest that I will work in somebody else's IP for as much money as I can grab. But it's being great fun to do. I'm looking forward to finishing that. Once that's done, I have half a dozen non-schlock mercenary stories coursing through my brain. I would like to write for Steve Jackson's Ogre universe. I'm going to do a little novelette or novella for him. And I have projects that the Writing Excuses team, writingexcuses.com podcast I do with Brandon Sanderson, Dan Wells, Mary Robin at Kalal, we have talked about putting together a collection of novelettes, novellas from each of us, that is exclusively available through Writing Excuses. I don't know what I would write there, and I don't know who would edit it, because again, you know, it's not for a large publisher. Eventually, yeah, I would love to write novels for Tor or Pyre or Ace or Penguin, or I don't know who publishes science fiction these days. I buy by the author.
And one of the other projects that you did recently that was posted on YouTube was a reward for Acts of Whimsy for a fundraiser.
Oh, yes, that was. I keep forgetting that one of my skills is the drop of a hat cartoonist. Cartoonists can take an idea and turn it into a visual literally in minutes. And Jay Lake, Mary Robinette Kowal and Catherine Schaefer put together a fundraiser so that Jay Lake could get his tumor sequence, genome sequencing, because the other treatments haven't been working well. Now, Jay is in serious, you know, medically, he's in very, very dire straits. And this treatment was not covered by his insurance. Very, very expensive. So they put together a fundraiser and basically announced your reward for participating in the fundraiser, for contributing, is that we authors will perform acts of mercy. And they shot past their $20,000 goal in a day. And Mary emailed me and said, can you do an act of whimsy? And I said, I'd love to. I will draw a picture of Jay kicking cancer's ass. And you pick the dollar amount that that needs to be at.
And it was $37,000.
It turned out to be $37,000. Yeah. And the more I thought about that, the more I realized that I couldn't just draw a single picture. It needed to tell a story. And so I created a comic on a single large, very large, like 19 by 24 inch board, a comic about how Jay can't find his cancer because it's a doppelganger. It looks exactly like him. And Mary Robinette's koala calls out to the internet and says, we need a genome sequencer. And the internet, as portrayed by John Scalzi and the Bacon Cat, summons a bunch of, and I drew all of the people who had participated in the acts of flimsy up to that point, summons that crowd, and they go charging off to get a genome sequencer, and they fire the sequencer at Jay and his doppelganger. The doppelganger turns into sort of a cancerous-looking blob, and then Jay kicks its ass, and we get to see the end. And that was so much fun to do, and it was so emotionally rewarding, because as I was drawing these faces of these friends of mine who participated in the fundraiser, I realized that I was, to an extent, putting on paper their enthusiasm and their hopes and their good feelings towards Jay in a way that their acts of whimsy hadn't yet hadn't necessarily communicated. And so it was a very, very spiritual experience, and so I have no qualms whatsoever about having spent 3 hours on a Sunday night working on it.
Yeah, and for anybody who doesn't know, Jay Lake is a very talented author, very beloved author in the community, who is, what stage is his cancer at now? Is it stage 4? Liver cancer.
Yeah, I don't know from stages. I know that he's past the point where the doctors originally said, this is how long you have to live.
Yeah.
And so he's been literally fighting for his life on borrowed time for a couple of years now, and he keeps beating it, and then it comes back. You know, I got the opportunity to talk to him at the World STEAM Expo I guess it was spring 2012. He was one of the guests of honor there, and he was hopeful and yet kind of resigned. He said, yeah, you know, the new estimates say I've got about this long to live, and I need longer than that because I want to watch my child graduate from high school.
And she's 14 right now.
And she's 14 right now.
And his odds are 8%. So
yeah, the odds are not fantastic. But with the genome sequencing, you know, if an answer comes up,
right,
the odds skyrocket, because suddenly they have a treatment path that wasn't open to them.
And what the genome sequencer is basically going to do is, sometimes, just because it's liver cancer, you don't actually know what that necessarily means. There's different kinds of cancers, and a genome sequencer allows you to have a much more precise idea of what exactly it is you're fighting, if I understand this correctly, and so they can then tailor the treatment to better target the chemotherapy. They'll be able to kill the cancer without taking Jay out in the process.
Which is always the trick with cancer.
Yeah. One more question just for both of you. It's more of a sort of a trivia question. We've already brought up that all of us are members of the same faith. We're all three of us members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is actually one of the most well-represented religious groups in science fiction and fantasy. And everybody's got their theories about why that is, ranging from we're all a bunch of kooks who believe science fiction anyway, to just that there's such a supportive community of already existing science fiction and fantasy writers that it sort of fosters an ongoing development of science fiction and fantasy in just within our sort of social community. Have you guys experienced a lot of sort of support and networking and, you know, have your goals been fostered at all, do you find, by being part of our faith?
Well, we live here in Utah where, you know, it's a high, high percentage of the population. And we have found a fantastic community here. And this community, I mean, whenever we have local conventions or stuff, or events, that question gets asked. And the truth is, none of us, we all have guesses, or theories or whatever, but I think community is a big aspect of it. Mormons are taught from a very, very young age how to be part of a community. You know, there's programs and all the structure of the church is, you know, watch out for your neighbor, you know, communicate, and everybody gets shifted in jobs so that you do one job for a while and then you do a different job for a while. So, you know, first you're working with the kids, then you're working with the teens, then you're back working with the kids. And there's, everyone expects to do lots of different things, which means everybody learns how to network and build communities on almost a subliminal level, which means that once we start thinking about writing or being a writer, we know how to network in ways that other people have to actively learn, I think. Or at least that's my experience. I mean, I had to learn to do some active networking. Howard understood it much better than I did when we first got married. But
I get asked all the time why so many Mormons are science fiction writers, and my first response is, really? You know, there's 12 million of us who are Mormons.
And we're actually up to 14. We got 14 as of last conference.
14 now.
Yeah.
Yep.
14 million.
How many Mormon science fiction writers can you name off the top of your head? The reason that people see lots of Mormon science fiction writers is that if you are Mormon, you tend to wear it on your sleeve.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that in a bad way. It's just, it's part of the, it's part of the cultural prerogative. It's how our faith works. There are Mormons who look at it and who say, oh, Mormons are science fiction writers because Mormonism hangs together like a really, really good piece of world building, and so science fiction fits well for us. I look at that and I say, no, there's a lot of things that hang together well as world building, including, but not limited to, atheism. No, we can't put that stake in the ground. I look at it, and my philosophy is that it's a meme and a monoculture. Here in Utah County, we have a massive monoculture, and I would argue that it's the most successful one on the planet. We have lots and lots and lots of white-bred, right-wing, suburban-living, traditional family Mormons. We've got at least six multi-level marketing headquarters located here in Utah, because we are neighbors and we go to church together and we all have similar beliefs. And that's not to say that there aren't people here who don't believe that way, that there aren't, you know, cultural minorities, but certainly the overwhelming number of us do. And so when something takes off, it spreads like wildfire. And we had back in the 80s a science fiction club at BYU that brought in writers, and they did wonderful things, and the Life, the Universe, and Everything convention taught people that you could actually make a living at science fiction, and the science fiction fans in Mormondom, that meme just took off among them, and meme in a monoculture. We have no immunity against science fiction, and so we write it. It's science fiction, fantasy, whatever, mm-hmm. You know, speculative fiction, genre fiction.
Well, and an important thing to note is that for all the science fiction oriented Mormons and that you meet, I still get, you know, I'll meet people and they're members of the church, and I'll be like, so you can make a living at that? You know, they're just very, very puzzled or confused by what we do, completely baffled.
You write fantasy, you write fantasy, and people say, oh, well, it's, you know, it's good that you found a productive way to do that. At least you don't play Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
And then we say, that's Fridays, every Friday. Do you want to see the horns? I do. You'll see the, oh my goodness, there is still, I say meme in a monoculture, there are aspects of this monoculture of ours that are incredibly intolerant towards things that they don't understand.
Yeah.
And I like being in a position as a professional humorist, as somebody who is glib and outspoken and doesn't have a whole lot to hide. I like calling that stuff out and making fun of it.
Yeah, my background is I'm actually a convert, and I probably have one of the quirkiest LDS science fiction crossroads stories. I was baptized by Orson Scott Card's son. Randomly. Just one of those things. Thank you guys so very much for taking the time to talk to me and all of us here at Blackgate. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
No problem at all.